Mr. Herbert Carlbaugh.
I've just learned that your chairman is a neighbor of mine. I live in Darien, Connecticut, a town that's had a little publicity during the past year. And it's still going on. And I'm sure it's in keeping with some of the subjects that have been under discussion this week. Because broadcasting occupies some part of almost everybody's life, to be objective about it is not a simple matter. In my case, the broadcasting industry has occupied 32 years of my experience and existence. How I could stand it for 32 years, I don't know. At the end of that period, with no axe to grind, I can honestly say that I am thoroughly biased in its favor and in the remarkable stimulus that it gives to business activity. No more do you find such a thing as the small town rule. He's gone forever. And the small town women are as well dressed and as well informed as their counterparts in the metropolitan centers. I believe that television has had a tremendous influence in this area. That is my vantage point, and the only vantage point from which I can assess broadcasting's responsibility. My hope is that in this assessment, I will not exemplify the research man who was drowned crossing a river with an average depth of 3 feet. And from this standpoint of my bias, the first responsibility of broadcasting is to meet the moral obligation of its creation. Within that frame of reference, its next responsibility is to perpetuate its survival and to realize its own potential. Broadcasting's responsibility means a number of different things. Whatever it means, this responsibility rests finally with the individual station licensed to serve a designated area. It is plain that unless the management of the station lives up to its responsibilities to its stockholders, the station will either go out of existence or have to be sold. Those are the plain facts of life. Since a large number of stations are affiliated with networks, failure to carry with reasonable regularity the network's commercial programs, they will cut down the network revenue, thus affecting the ability of the network to provide proper program service for its affiliated stations to broadcast to their communities. Another responsibility or obligation of the station is to broadcast programs which are designed to attract and satisfy large audiences within the community it serves. Now, some of the critics of the medium decry television's efforts to appeal to large audiences. I am certain, in spite of this not too carefully thought out criticism, you will agree that should the station not do this, there would be a serious question as to whether it was properly serving the set owners in the area where it was licensed. I happen to be a trustee of a library in Connecticut. I can't imagine this library, for example, discharging its obligation to the community by filling its stacks with books at the Marcel Proust level. Certain limitations are inherent in any medium that directs its appeal to the mass. These limitations are naturally concerned with the responsibility to consider the tastes and needs of minority groups. The problem of appealing to these special interests of smaller audiences and at the same time providing service to a larger audience as possible is not a simple matter. Being the same thing to all men, the implied responsibility of the license to broadcast for the public interest, convenience, and necessity, that's government language, is very much like the position in which the man found himself when his aunt presented him with two ties for Christmas. When he wore one of them to satisfy the dear old lady, her eyes filled with tears as she said, "You don't like the other one." I experienced this tug of war between special interests when I was at CBS in charge of program practices and television. The chairman has explained my department, so I won't go into that. But as a consequence, I've been exposed to varying degrees of pressure from more groups than I can recollect. Most of them were intensely forthright, but ranged from alpha to omega in organizational purpose and character. For instance, executive producers and producers. There's a difference. Directors, story editors, casting directors, film editors, and sometimes their relatives and friends. Script writers, sales managers, advertising managers, presidents of companies, millions of vice presidents, hypnotists, extrasensory perceptionists, Buddhists, spies from behind the Iron Curtain. Believe me, they've come to us. Phrenologists, physiognomists, and vivisectionists, psychiatrists, psychologists, handwriting experts, the ancient order of the Hibernians. Almost every racial, ethnic, and religious group, including three ministers from Pennsylvania who wanted us to cancel out the Playhouse 90 series in behalf of wrestling. The American Medical Association, the American Dental Association, the American Humane Association, pawn shop associations, a group opposed to making a laughingstock out of men's hair pieces, the Funeral Directors Association, Parole Officers Association, the FBI, the FTC, the FDA, the NAACP, and the NCAA. B'nai B'rith, the American Library Association, astrologers, subliminal perceptionists, and a small group of ladies who objected to a Revlon nail enamel commercial because the shade was designated as red caviar. There were endless numbers of actors and actresses with their managers, lawyers and sponsors, police and fire departments, horse racing touts, the National Association of Broadcasters, etc., etc. Now, this almost endless parade of groups naturally came forward, each to present to the network a self-serving point of view. This is as it should have been, because although a few were not only unreasonable, but downright militant, many were extremely helpful. Furthermore, the network's decision-making process was honed sharp by this abrasive action of opinion and counter-opinion. Interestingly, in this welter of ebb and flow of self-interest, Alcoholics Anonymous loomed conspicuously for its dignity, its restraint, and its high principles in dealing with the network. The Federal Communications Commission of the United States and its counterpart in Canada have accepted as an operating principle the need to allocate frequencies so that they can serve as many people as possible. It would be a waste of facilities if this implied mandate of the license to broadcast were not carried out. Hence, the station operator has a natural urge, aside from the standpoint of his survival in the broadcasting business, to actively engage the attention of as many people as he can. Now, let's examine what we call this so-called mass audience. Except under unusual circumstances, 4 out of 5 potential viewers will not be watching an individual channel, even during so-called prime time. 30 to 40% will not watch television at all, and many of the remainder will be watching a competing program. So this mass audience is really a minority audience to begin with, even though the total number of viewers is an impressive figure. A broadcaster is compelled to use every effort to enhance the size of this minority. I'm not revealing any professional programming techniques when I tell you he doesn't achieve this by scheduling a program, for instance, like How to Stuff an Owl. I just want to mention the subject of audience ratings very briefly. They have recently been the whipping boy of almost every critic in television. Certainly, individual judgment is not infallible. The experiences on Broadway certainly prove that out. The television industry must turn to people in the mass to get answers. Program ratings, more expensive and more elaborate than that used by any other medium, tell broadcasters that some programs are popular and some are not. These ratings may not be perfect, but I don't believe a broadcaster would be showing his dedication to responsibility by turning his back on them. There's a great deal of talk in the press, within government circles, within the broadcasting trade, and in general conversations that television programming is controlled by three or four men, that these men have, or presume to have, mysterious powers of divining what people will look at, or failing that, the brutal, brazen, relentless power to force their programs and programming ideas on the helpless public. Now, don't you believe it. Don't you believe it for 1 minute. The man in control is that viewer with show me in his eyes and with his hand on the on-off change channel switch. He is far more responsible for the shaping of programs than the broadcaster himself. An elaborate promotional red carpet is laid out to curry his favor because the stark reality which the broadcaster must face is that in any season between 40 and 50% of last year's new programs will have to go by the board. The dollars and represented in these unsuccessful ventures are, to use a Hollywood term, astronomical. The standard complaint of what the trade refers to as the egghead is that broadcasters provide too many programs for mass audiences. If you will examine the rating books, the program on How to Stuff an Owl might have been a wiser choice than some of the programs in the middle of the list. The problem lies in the scarcity of creative people, beginning with the all-important scriptwriter. A perfect example of this is the presence on this platform of Mr. J.P. Miller. How many J.P. Millers are there? And how many are available to television? Well, when you look at Mr. Miller, I hope he won't mind my saying this, you're looking at the Hope Diamond among scriptwriters. Some time ago, CBS embarked on a project to prime the programming pump by offering $10,000 per script for a new program series, each program to be scripted by a different writer. Because only a few qualified writers responded, the project had to be abandoned. This scarcity extends to producers, directors, actors, and believe it or not, even to cameramen. The legitimate theater, the publishing business, motion pictures, are also plagued by this dearth of creative talent. I'm sure that many of you share my nostalgia for the early days of television. The roller derbies, the lady wrestlers, the reruns of Popeye and Gene Autry. And how many remember Dagmar, the lady with the superb proportions who used to titillate the late evening audience? Boy, those were really the days. Now, many today refer to this as the golden era of broadcasting. In retrospect, many fine productions seem to stand out. The truth is that the rate of failure on a critical basis in those days was probably as much as 80%. If you were to screen the kinescopes of this early television fare, you would realize that most of it was mediocre at the best, and our memory is haunted by the occasional standout. There is an aspect in seeking large audiences which one really can easily lose sight of. Now, here's what Gilbert Seldes wrote in the late 30s, evaluating television. He said, "Radio is important because people listen to it even when it is trivial. The audience which listened to the radio debate on the Supreme Court was created in the first place by Ed Wynn, Rudy Vallee, Amos Nandy, and Kate Smith. I have a feeling that the most important thing for television is to make sure of its own popularity. Like the moving picture, radio, television would act against its own nature if it did not try to be virtually a universal entertainment." Now, Mr. Seldes wrote these words almost 30 years ago. An occurrence early this year in New York clearly proved the wisdom of his words. On February 22nd, Walter Lippmann broadcast on the Columbia Network from 10 to 11. The program achieved a rating of 10.3 in New York, a most respectable rating for a program of this kind. 10 days later, Mr. Lippmann made a widely publicized appearance before the United Nations from 8:30 to 9:15 p.m. This time, the TV viewers could see him on Channel 13 in New York, an educational channel. A good channel, but devoted to special interest and material of restricted interest to the mass audience. His audience in that instance was so small, no figure was reported, since the rating services give no detail on audience size of programs with a rating of 1.4 or lower. Audiences tend to tune and stay tuned to broadcast facilities which over a long period of time have satisfied their needs. In other words, whether you like Beverly Hillbillies or not, this program served as a springboard for Walter Lippmann. Now, how does Alcoholics Anonymous fit into the broadcast spectrum? It fits in the following area of responsibility of the medium. The responsibility for meeting the needs of groups known, for the lack of better word, the minority. And I trust you understand the word minority is not in a controversial sense. Included in this classification is public service broadcasting, community funds, public health and safety, appeals for support of broad gauge governmental projects and other enterprises for which broadcasting can provide substantial support. The discharge of this responsibility, however, involves many factors present in public affairs programming not generally known or recognized by the viewing public. While extensive cooperation by a number of people is sought and required by the producer of a documentary, it is vital to know what motivates this friendly hand of help. Is it entirely gratuitous, or is there an unrecognized angle of self-interest? Has the integrity of the program been unknowingly sold down the river for the unannounced benefit of the person or group so freely offering help? The health field, for instance, has been somewhat difficult for broadcasters to evaluate in the allocation of public service cooperation. In the first place, the government of the United States is by far the largest contributor in many important health classifications. Some charitable enterprises, in seeking to front run in their categories, have incurred, unfortunately, high costs of administration and have not clearly spelled out how the money raised would be spent. One instance that I'm quite familiar with in the health field, this involved a new project already covered by a well-established public service institution. This new project had a famous name on its masthead. The investigation revealed that a relative of the famous name, while not part of the salaried staff, was given a really large expense account and was also scheduled for speech making at very fancy, high prices. The result was that the largesse extended to the sufferers was really small s, with only 50 cents out of every dollar raised spent for the announced purpose of the project. This is what is known as the gray area in public service. Many will contend that this is the only way that you can prime the pump of public service giving and support. That every institution in public service started in this manner so as to avoid falling back on a tin cup. Well, I know one institution that didn't start in this way and has never operated in that way. Alcoholics Anonymous, assembled here today. That is why networks or stations must have complete control of public service shows. It is vital that they have complete knowledge of all the source material. Not only the material itself, but how it was secured. Only by complete participation in the myriad details and elements can networks or stations feel secure against embarrassing consequences. One of the bulwarks in maintaining high standards and alert watchfulness in the public service field is an organization known as the Advertising Council. This is not a profit-making organization. It's entirely non-profit and in the public interest. Their whole purpose is to promote public service projects and mass media. In doing this, they have established criteria to which these projects must comply in order to secure support. They also allocate time for campaigns, so to space them out throughout the year, thus avoiding overlap. For instance, CBS will not schedule public service material unless it meets the standards of the Advertising Council. As you know, Alcoholics Anonymous has full advertising, counsel, support, and allocation. That broadcasting has met its responsibility in this area far exceeds what you might suspect. When Judge Medina, chairman of the New York Bar Association's Committee on Mass Media, asked the Television Information Office for a list of programs that dealt with the law and legislative processes that had been broadcast by the three networks over a four-year period, he was surprised to learn that the list ran to more than 400 programs. Not all of these programs were designed for the single purpose of instructing people in legal procedures. That's not the way of television. What television does best is to create a framework within which information and, for instance, public service can be transmitted, most often under the guise of entertainment or general enlightenment rather than pure instruction. This multiplying factor obviously extends the reach of the public service message many times over. One of the most graphic examples of this reach was the story of Alcoholics Anonymous as dramatized in The Days of Wine and Roses, created by Mr. J.P. Miller on Playhouse 90 on the Columbia Network and later repeated as a motion picture. Millions of viewers saw this program and witnessed a vivid and dramatic demonstration of the good works of Alcoholics Anonymous integrated as a vital part of the storyline. I am certain that all of you realize the significance of this incident. Just to give you an idea of the impact of a program of this kind, this is just sort of gee whiz information, but the impact of television shows by estimate that more people have seen the performances of Shakespeare's plays in television and have been performed on all the world stages in all the years since they were written. Now, how can we raise the level of awareness of our people about what is going on in the world or about our culture, a great residue of world experience? Television offers endless opportunities to meet this challenge. Unfortunately, the institutions which could take advantage of these opportunities, the church and the school, have let go by the board thousands of programs which could have been studied or used as the basis for the intelligent consideration of almost all the matters that interest or concern us. Think again about the program The Days of Wine and Roses. What better subject for a common viewing experience by the clergy, teachers, young people, and adults? Fortunately, there are some encouraging signs that attempts are being made by both church and schools, and I have a happy experience of having personally helped in such activities, working with two national church groups and with colleges and high schools. But there is much to be done. I recommend that Alcoholics Anonymous, working in advance of programs which include the Alcoholics Anonymous story, promote tie-in activity by churches and schools. The rich dividends of resultant good to Alcoholics Anonymous would be limitless and would serve as a demonstration of how television, to use the words of a prominent TV producer, might save the world. The coverage that Alcoholics Anonymous has had in television within the range of my personal participation at CBS is quite impressive. Aside from The Days of Wine and Roses, here are some of the network shows that I work with. Never Again, produced by Alfred Hitchcock. The story was based upon the tragic consequences that resulted from a misunderstanding which caused a young lady to break away from her Alcoholics Anonymous discipline. Another distinguished program in the Armstrong Circle Theater series called Journey to Oblivion dealt with the story of a socially prominent suburbanite wife who, as an alcoholic, refused to recognize her addiction to liquor until faced with a major crisis in her life. The Defenders series, a series devoted to themes sometimes of important social issues, last year presented a program called Drink Like a Lady. This program dealt with the help that Alcoholics Anonymous gave to an alcoholic woman who had killed a man, presumably in self-defense, during an alcoholic blackout. The CBS series called The Nurses presented a program entitled Fly Shadow. dealing with a nurse who conceals with nearly disastrous results a woman's alcoholism because events in her own past caused her to take pity on the patient. There are others, but these examples are a demonstration of the best way that television can meet its responsibility in the area of public service. Fortunate indeed is Alcoholics Anonymous that its principles and its unique character adapts itself so readily to storylines with deep human interest. Obviously, the integration of public service teams must be handled carefully and sparingly by the networks. They must be the result of self-inspiration of the scriptwriter. They cannot appear to be dragged in by the heels. As a result, the majority of television coverage in behalf of formal public service campaigns is in the form of short, filmed, or recorded announcements. Unfortunately, the Federal Communications Commission, forgive me for always referring to the United States with all our Canadian friends present, but that's been the range of my experience, with its own brand of infinite wisdom, does not permit a station or a network to take credit in the public service category for any entertainment programs into which public or social service material has been integrated. Hence, the most effective forms of public service in broadcasting go unsung as far as the FCC is concerned. In addition to the Alcoholics Anonymous themes and programs I have mentioned, there have been brilliantly written and produced entertainment programs surrounding such important public problems as child adoption, unwed mothers, social disease, quackery and medicine, juvenile delinquency, and many others. I realize that the Federal Communications Commission might plead difficulty in evaluating programs which marry entertainment or social service. Difficult as it may be, the FCC must give stations and networks incentive to broadcast public service in its most provocative form, instead of only giving them public service credit for material which is comparatively trite and restricted in audience interest. Our relationship with Alcoholics Anonymous when I was at CBS was indeed a very happy one. Here was a group held together by the strongest spiritual bonds, a familiar trappings, formal public service organization, below-the-line necessities that didn't seem to exist, no broad-scale fundraising or drive for members or elaborate administrative setup. I'm not critical of these devices, because they are vital to most organizations. I am only saying that when I came here last night, I was startled, just like I've been startled in the past, to come so quickly upon the good works of Alcoholics Anonymous. The pure gold is right on the surface, and the lode runs very deep. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Carbon. Thank you for the knowledge you've given us, for the ideas you've given us. And thank you for your most generous appraisal of AA's public relations attitude. We have a speaker today who's a newspaper man with a strong background in religious and in alcoholism work. George N. Collins, during 25 years with the Boston Globe, has been sports writer, news photo editor, news editor, assistant financial editor, and religion editor. He has served as a union officer, been elected to public office in 3 different communities. He's been heavily involved in Boy Scout work and youth work. He's a United Church of Christ layman, serves on Christian Unity and Alcoholism Committees at local, state, and national level. He serves as advisor to the North Conway Institute for Alcoholism Education. This is a joint effort supported by a wide representation of churches. Although we're not affiliated with Mr. Collins, we are delighted that he's cooperating so wholeheartedly with us here today. Mr. George M. Collins.
Thank you, Murray, and ladies and gentlemen. The general procedure at small gatherings such as this is for the speaker to attempt to establish a quick rapport with the audience by telling a story. The other night in Chicago, I flew here from an assignment in Chicago, and I must return this afternoon. I'm sorry to say, I didn't know exactly how friendly this group was. But then again, when I'm through, perhaps I'd better leave. Maybe this yellow light up here stands for okay, coward, you got 2 minutes to get out of the hall. But the other night in Chicago, at the Religious Newswriters Association annual awards meeting, a world-famed novelist, not Mr. Miller, attempted to establish a quick rapport with this group of religious newswriters. He opened his speech with this line, quote, "I once knew a cab driver by the name of Crooked Neck Zeckel." And then he waited for the laughs. And they didn't come. And so he plunged on for 45 minutes of torture. This almost made me change my plan to start with a story. But is it? Inasmuch as there ought to be one amateur in the group, following Mr. Kahlborg and before Mr. Miller, I'll try it anyway. There is a tendency at meetings of any kind to give the impression that the speakers are all experts in their field. As a newsman who has attended hundreds of meetings, I know this isn't a fact. And after this talk is over, you'll all know it too. But I've always studiously avoided becoming an expert. It's too confining. I won't talk about the newspaper business today because one of my bosses is sitting in front of me. I think I've had him fooled for 26 years. I don't want him to learn how little I know. But we once had one of the greatest experts of all time at the Boston Globe. He's dead now, and we revere him, but we can't refrain from telling the story. And it's a story... It's an actual happening that has been one of my credos as to why never to become an expert on anything. Or at least not an expert's expert. He was our harness horse rider. The most aptly named harness horse rider that ever lived. His name was Trot. Frank rode harness horse racing for 35 years. He started every story he ever wrote with the words, "breed a mare," and finished every story with the line, "raise a colt." I don't know whether this is Planned Parenthood or 100% success. But in those 35 years, he became such an expert that he knew of every horse, its sire, its dam, its time of running any given distance. He could tell you this, and this is what he wrote. But somewhere along the line, he forgot that he was a reporter. One day at the Brighton Speedway, which no longer exists in Boston, in the days before paramutual racing, they were having a friendly little race, as they had every Saturday, and they used to get quite a few people out in the stands, and one day a rather fractious horse went through the rail up into the grandstand and put 27 people in the Massachusetts General Hospital. The Boston Post, the Record American, and the Boston Herald came out Sunday morning with page one headlines. 27 hospitalized as horse bolts track, etc., etc., etc. In between the lines, "breed a mare and raise a colt," we didn't have anything about it. Our city editor was, of course, of the first mind that once again the Post, Record American, and Herald had missed the boat. But then he thought they couldn't have done it all together at once. So he assigned a young reporter to call up Mr. Trot on the phone and ask him if it had really happened. So the young fella called Frank, and he got him out of bed. It was at least 9:30. And Frank came on, and he came from up country, and he still retained the accent. And he came on, and the young reporter said, Mr. Trott, the city editor wanted me to call you. There are three papers in here, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. He told him what the other papers said. The city editor would like to know if this really happened. And Frank said, hey, yeah. So the kid was a little flabbergasted, and he said, well, Mr. Trott, the city editor would also like to know why we don't have it. And Frank gave the expertise of all time when he replied, son, once the horse leaves the track, he's out of my jurisdiction. Well, now, if I can keep you in that frame of mind, I may get out of here. Perhaps you're probably wondering what a religion editor, quote, or writer is doing sitting with a playwright and an advertising man. Newspaper men are supposed to deal with facts, and these men, we are told, often deal more in the realm of fantasy. Well, in the first place, my being here is fantasy. At least it's fantastic. A few years ago, all I knew about AA was that many of my best friends were in it. And what I saw the program do for them left me a bit envious at times. Why, I used to think, couldn't I find an organization that would help me stop looking for ways to avoid work? The way they seemed to be able to handle their biggest problem. Of course, I didn't know how much work it was for them to handle that problem. But let's look at the public looking in on the AA for a minute, and this is where we get to amateur hour. You got the hook ready? They may not think of it this way, this is the public, but they see in AA the biggest, most successful, do-it-yourself project in the history of mankind. Far be it from me to forget the part that God, or however you see the supreme power, plays in the role of each individual struggle, but I must emphatically say that I find fewer hypocrites amongst the pillars of AA than amongst the pillars of the structured church, no matter what the faith. I get in trouble when I say something like that to church people. The admission that you must seek help from a power greater than oneself to return to and maintain a sane and happy life is seldom thought of by non-alcoholic persons as needed in their lives except between 11 and 12 on Sundays. I would like to say at the outset that as an onlooker of AA, I see a highly successful organization with a great potential to perform an even greater service to people than it has to date, and the past 30 years have been triumphant in achievements. Perhaps it's time for another Jack Alexander-type National Magazine article aimed at answering some of the unreasonable critics of AA who have been popping out of the woodwork these past few years. I originally wrote Up From Under Rocks, but I changed it to Woodwork. But we all realize, I'm sure, that any time a person or organization is successful, they become target for the day with all the professional carpers. And human nature makes us want to see the successful fellow taken down a peg or two. But I would like to say something which I hope will be constructive criticism. The public also looks upon AA, at least some members do, as a somewhat private, secretive body with an admission price and membership charge that they either do not want to pay or find not necessary to be concerned with. I don't want to give the impression here that I think AA should ever consider admitting non-alcoholics to its ranks willy-nilly. Of course, it is practically impossible for you to keep them out if for some reason they feel it a benefit to join. And here, of course, I'm not speaking of your auxiliary organization. The public also sees other things when it looks at AA. I'd like to speak generally to two of them. They see a tendency for some individual AA people to treat the organization as a cult, and sometimes with accompanying scoffing at the institutional church. They also see AA as not quite a community organization. That is to say, AA is available in the community, but not always is AA a part of the community. But AA is not the only alcoholism agency guilty of producing this feeling. Let me talk to the thought that AA has a secret of image. We don't have to discuss the need for individual anonymity for an alcoholic attempting to make a recovery. Society sets up this need. Society's treatment of alcoholics as community lepers is highly frustrating and reprehensible, but it took centuries for society to gain an enlightened outlook about persons suffering from leprosy. So, too, alcoholics have to fight for public and social acceptance of their illness. You know better than I the stigma attached to alcoholism. Why this still persists after 30 years of AA success is curious. Could it possibly be that by carrying individual anonymity to the fine line which you have achieved, that you have hidden too well the fact that with help from AA and or other disciplines, an alcoholic can recover? Society walls off the alcoholic naturally. It's frustrating, but entirely normal. This walling off, to my mind, makes clear the fact that more people would accept alcoholism as a disease and see the need to support alcoholism programs if given more simple, clear, easily understood information about the disease. By natural means, our bodies automatically attempt to wall off any diseased area. By nature, we all dislike what we don't understand. Combine these two factors, and it's understandable why society reacts adversely to alcoholics and alcoholism. But this can be corrected in time with information. And this information must reach the public through all available media. But how has some of this knowledge been portrayed with resulting polarization of images by the non-alcoholic public? AA hasn't been as guilty as some agencies in the matter of misinformation and statistics, but it hasn't been entirely innocent. Scare techniques have long since been discredited in scientific circles as a method of educating the masses. Look at cigarettes and lung cancer. Just a week or so ago, the U.S. tobacco industry reported a sales increase of some 20 million more packs of cigarettes this past year over the year before. And this after all the cancer scare stories. I smoke Winston's myself. Commercials aren't allowed. He talked about CBS. You can plug your last book, J.P. And this after all the cancer scare stories and statistics that the government and other anti-smoking agencies could produce. It would seem that the tobacco people had a better advertising technique. I'm always curious about that Lucky Strike commercial, LSMFT. Everybody in the room undoubtedly knows it stands for Lucky Strike means fine tobacco. You go look at it. It does. It's chopped up finer than any other tobacco and any other cigarette. Detroit learned long ago that women buy the family car, so they dressed it up for the ladies. Now the liquor industry has quit concentrating on telling men how male they are if they drink their product. Now the agencies and producers are gearing their ad programs and products to the gals. We know we have a can of worms already under the old push. What lies ahead frightens me even more. A week or so ago at a conference of an interfaith, interdisciplinary organization geared to stimulating education on alcoholism. Several AA members are on their board of directors. A sociologist from the University of Pennsylvania sharply scored scare campaigns and laid particular stress on what he called the G-Whiz School of Statistics. AA has not been as guilty as many in talking about who, what, where, when, and how. Did you hear that, boss? I got all the things the news story's supposed to have. About who, what, where, when, and how many are alcoholics. But these guesstimates are not helping the cause, no matter what their source. You may not agree, but as a non-alcoholic, non-scientist, I must stress the need for accurate figures, and beyond that, for accurate follow-up data on alcoholics, if any scientific approach is to be valid on alcoholism. I said earlier that the public looks on AA as a somewhat secretive society. It also looks on AA too often as a professional organization. Why this phenomenon? My experience on this in talking with non-alcoholics who have attended public meetings is that they have too often heard only the old-timers tell their stories. The 20 to 30-year folks. Sometimes they are too professional in the telling of their stories. Some are geared more to evoke laughs with the timing of an old vaudeville star than to produce a feeling of conviction. I'm not suggesting these speakers aren't for real. I'm just saying some of them have lost their realism. Another thing that has disturbed me at meetings I have attended, and I'm sure disturbs other visitors and hurts AA. This is the reaction of some individuals to a person who shows up at a meeting under the influence. Many people reach out to them and welcome. But for some, the walling off takes place right there. To a visitor, this looks more than a little contradictory. Sometimes I would suggest we can all get a little too expert. The track doesn't end at the railings. The people getting hurt are always on the outside of the rail. I said earlier that many people see AA as an organization in the community, but not part of the community. There are ads in the paper telling where AA meets. The church and synagogue calendars in hundreds of communities tell of meeting dates and places. Often AA members appear before service clubs, school, and church groups. But too often, this is the extent of the public's knowledge of AA and what it offers. This is not a condemnation of the AA public information program. This possibly is more a condemnation of the public and how the information program is conducted down at the local level. How often are official efforts made to invite people to public meetings? Has AA become too much of a come organization rather than a go organization? The churches fell into that trap, and now in the United States there are 75 million persons who listed no church affiliation in the last national census. The churches are now reevaluating themselves in the light of this information. I look with a jaundiced eye at some of the reevaluators. After 30 years of slow, uphill slugging, can AA afford to be a come organization? If not, I have no easy answer for reaching out to the public. The newspapers, for instance, find in all their readership surveys that the comic pages are the best read pages inside the paper. Perhaps that's where your public notices should be placed for best readership. But I will suggest one possible area. I wasn't poking fun. I was stating a fact. That is the best page to advertise on. But I will suggest one possible area for AA individuals and officialdom to make a reevaluation of effort for sharing knowledge with the community. Last spring at Tuxedo Park, New York, AA General Service Board members sat in conference with leaders of other agencies and representatives of Protestant, Roman Catholic, Orthodox, and Jewish faiths. They discussed how the churches could help in this struggle. It's taken a long time for that to happen. There are many valid reasons why individual AA members have rejected working with the clergy in the past. Many of you were rejected by clergymen when you or your families needed help. This happened for many reasons. Those of you, and I know there are thousands, who help clergymen aid alcoholics and their families understand the usual reasons. In the first place, most clergymen have never received any training in working with alcoholics and their families. The seminaries just don't teach it. Some of the clergy have a habit of saying, "Oh, I don't have that problem in my parish. I have a very close friend who's an AA, who is a priest, who when he heard this said at one of these meetings, said to the, it was one of his own, as we say in Boston, who another Catholic priest who had made this remark, he looked at him across the room and he said, "Hell, Father, you haven't got a parish." But most clergymen, let's face this fact too, cannot drop everything when a call comes in from an alcoholic or his family. And you know what the reaction is to a 1, 2, or 3 hour wait. But now things are changing drastically, and hopefully. A survey of 7,500 clergymen of the four major faiths picked at random across the U.S. and Canada completed this month, found 98% of them clamoring for help in aiding alcoholics and their families. Many of them indicated they were now getting help from AA, all clamored for more tools with which to work. Now they're saying to you and every other agency, we need help. To your people who have given up on the clergy, I would urge that they turn the other cheek. Go back, offer help to the community's clergy. Help them to set up a parish team to work with those in need. You know that you don't have all the answers. They don't either. But those of you who are already working in this type of team know that you have a possible chance for better success in reaching out to people and helping people than when you worked alone. Help them set up a parish team to work with those in need. Tell them who they'll need on the team. Some of them aren't even aware they might need a lawyer. Share with them the knowledge you have and allow them an opportunity to increase their service to your neighbors. Alcoholism, and I speak now as a not too long time religion writer, but a guy who's been interested in Christian unity for a long time. Alcoholism is the most ecumenical field in the world of religion today. Perhaps this ecumenism hasn't reached your town yet, but it can. There isn't any denominationalism in alcoholism. I would propose that AA members infiltrate the churches with an awareness. You like that word? Some of you will probably quote that. I'll digress for a minute. I was covering a Unitarian Universalist International Convention a month ago, and a clergyman got up and went into the worst racist, anti-Catholic diatribe I've ever heard in my whole life for 20 minutes. And then he turned around. He was standing 12 feet from the press table. He turned around and said, "Now, I don't want to read a line of that in the Boston papers." So we put it on page one with big headlines. We didn't know he was around under the primeval ooze in that part of Boston, but now everybody does. I would propose that AA members infiltrate the churches with an awareness of the need for responsible use of alcohol and with the awareness that people can be helped. The charges voiced by people such as Dr. Arthur Keane and his national articles of cultism in AA, I feel, are geared more to sensationalism than scientific fact. In his last two articles, the doctor made a strong plea for AA to help in the assembling of valid statistical data. And then he spiced up his article with the attacks based on generalizations. I don't think he can have both sides of the cake at once. But right now, he and others can attack AA at will and get away with it. They know that the organization will not defend itself in the same medium. That's why I said earlier that perhaps another Jack Alexander-type article is needed. But if it is written, it should be 100% honest in its appraisal. But I think you must come to agreement with the plea for accurate data. Regardless of what was valid when you started this fight 30 years ago, I think somehow you must multiply your efforts many-fold to cooperate with all of the other agencies and disciplines in seeking answers to the why of alcoholism. And somehow the public must be made aware that you were doing this. Well, I've been critical. I hope I've been constructive. You all know now how little I, as one of the public, know about AA. The basic reason for this may be that AA, while achieving success by group therapy, sometimes gives the impression that a group is always more than two. As the Quakers would say, me and thee. The best lasting work being done with people is still on an individual basis. Several longtime AA members told me before I came to Toronto to say anything I wanted to you folks. Some even said, "George, it won't make any difference anyway." I choose not to believe the latter remark. AA, to me, has been and still is the best available program today for helping active alcoholics to maintain a happy sobriety. I only ask, as a parent and a churchman, that AA's sharing of knowledge be continued and expanded. The race of life is a tough one, and the track has no set confines. We can't afford an attitude on any subject in life that once the horse has left the track, he's out of our jurisdiction. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Collins. Joy.
Our final speaker is responsible for a piece of writing which has very likely brought more people to AA than any other single piece. J.P. Miller, and I try to run those letters together the way he likes to have them without any periods between, was born in San Antonio, Texas. His father was a construction engineer, and his mother had been a road company actress. He studied to be a sculptor, but he said that when he found himself yelling at the stone, "Come out of there!" he decided to look elsewhere for a career. He had studied drama at Yale and had written verse. So after a number of years, as variously a ranch hand, shrimp fisherman, grave digger, prize fighter, says he won eight and then lost one, the last one. Refrigeration engineer, newspaper reporter, Spanish instructor, and 4 years in the Navy as a gunnery officer and deep sea diver. He tried his hand at a TV script, Hide and Seek, and it was produced, the first one, by Philco. This started him on a career which saw him contribute many other scripts to Philco and other TV anthologies, including Playhouse 90. It was the latter which produced his famed Days of Wine and Roses, later made into an Academy Award nominee film starring Jack Lemmon. J.P. Miller also wrote the screenplay for the movie version. Among his better-known television dramas are The Rabbit Trap, also made into a film, Old Tasselfoot, and Pardon Me, Boy. There's a great deal more I could tell you about J.P. Miller, but I can't wait to hear him. J.P. Miller.
A lot of other things about me I'm glad you can't tell. This is Public Information Day, it seems, and Mr. Carl Borg talked about public information from the standpoint of television, broadcasting, and showed marvelous critical acumen, I thought, when speaking of writers. And Mr. Collins talked about public information from the standpoint of the churchman. And I'd like to talk about it from the standpoint of a drinker. Before coming here today, I appointed myself the personal representative several million people all over the world, the big drinkers, that great army of men and women everywhere who, while they have not yet achieved true alcoholism, are trying their best to get there. And millions of them are going to make it, too. I don't know how many millions. I've read a lot of statistics on it. which are so conflicting they don't really mean anything, but millions means a lot to me. That scares me right there. Millions of vodka drinkers in Russia and Poland, and millions of wine drinkers in Western Europe, and millions of scotch and bourbon drinkers in America. That's a lot of drinkers. We don't have to argue with the statisticians about a million or two of them. We got them to spare. I'm not going to go into my own qualifications in detail for this honorary office I've bestowed upon myself. I haven't got the nerve to stand up here in front of a group of alcoholics and brag about my drinking any more than I have to go to a New York Yankee baseball banquet and brag about pitching for a semi-pro ball club. Let me just say that over a period of years, I've done my best to establish my reputation among my friends as a dependable man with all the products of the brewer's art, regardless of race, creed, or color. The only trouble with my drinking is that it's been retrogressing in the past few years. Instead of progressing normally as the years go by to a nice steady pattern of comfortable saturation or even alcoholism, as many of my friends have done, I found myself backing away from more drinks and avoiding patterns like poison. And that's your fault. Or rather, that's partly your fault. It's about 50-50, I should say. Half your fault for being there, and half my fault for being lucky and bumping into you. And it's that 50% or more of luck that was required in my case that I want to complain a little bit about. Back in the late 50s, I was working out in Hollywood where you may have heard quite a bit of drinking goes on. And I was doing my part as usual, trying to uphold the reputation of the place. I had heard of Alcoholics Anonymous, as most people had. I knew it existed, but I didn't know anything about it. I only knew that through some mysterious alchemy, drunks went in there and got sober. As far as I was concerned, I didn't need to know any more about it than that. You get sick, you go to the hospital. You don't have to know how to do the appendectomy yourself. Besides, I didn't care about all that stuff. I was too busy having fun. This was one of those periods in my life when I decided everything could be solved by quitting Hollywood. Quitting Hollywood, once you've got the habit, is like quitting smoking. It's very hard to do, and you can always think of a reason for going back. Anyhow, on this particular occasion, I quit and went back to New York feeling very pure because I was no longer making any money. That lasted much longer than I intended, long after the purity wore off. Then along came one of those providential happenings, which we hardly notice at the time, but which we look back on and find that they've changed our lives. A New York television producer named Fred Coe asked me to write an original drama for him to be done on Playhouse 90. He said he wanted strong subjects, like divorce, which I also knew something about, insanity, alcoholism. Was I interested in any of those subjects? And I told him the subject of alcoholism had always touched me very deeply because I had an uncle who was an alcoholic, as everyone does. He had spread havoc around him for 30 years and had then recovered in Alcoholics Anonymous and become a very successful businessman and even somewhat belatedly a very successful family man. And that night I got the idea for a story which later turned out to be Days of Wine and Roses. And I started going to AA meetings on account of that. Purely by happenstance, I had to go for research for my story. didn't touch me personally one bit. I would go to a meeting and listen to the stories, cry a little bit sometimes, and then I'd go and have coffee afterwards with Eve or some of the other wonderful people who were helping me, and then I would meet some of my friends and have a few blasts and talk them to death about what a wonderful thing those alcoholics had got on. And then I'd go home, business as usual. And then one night at an AA meeting, a very strange thing happened. Man got up to talk, and as I looked at him, it was almost like seeing myself through the wrong end of a telescope 20 years in the future. He was about 60 years old, white-haired. That part wasn't 20 years in the future. He was about my size, stoop-shouldered. You'll notice physical similarities. And it was a little eerie to me because he really did look like me, older. And then he began to speak with a Texas accent. Told about how he had been brought up in a home where liquor was not allowed. And as soon as he got away from it, he started drinking like a fish to prove to his mother who was boss. And I laughed a little bit to myself because that was another thing we had in common. And as he continued, it was almost as though somebody who knew about my past had rigged up a joke on me. He was really telling my life story. He'd been in the Navy, so had I. He had drunk much in many ports, and so had I. And he had been lucky in his early years and had never gotten into any serious trouble, no matter what he did. My story. He had also been the life of the party and a champion volume drinker, and he had never suffered from hangovers either. He even told the story of how they had put a water glass full of plain, undiluted whiskey in his hand while he was telling the story, and he'd drink it and act like he didn't even know the difference and wouldn't let him see any effect. And that had happened to me, too. Then, at the age of 40, his life took a different turn. And I was 38 at the time I listened to this story. He got up one morning after a long, wonderful party, and he had a bad case of shakes for the first time in his life. He also had a vague, hollow buzzing in his head, but the shakes were the worst part. He tried his usual breakfast of 3 black coffees and 3 cigarettes, and that didn't help any. He was due on an important appointment that morning, and he was sort of amused to find himself in that condition. Never thought it happened to him, but he wasn't too worried about it. He'd always heard of the hair of the dog, and he decided that this would be a very good time to try it, and he tried it. And it worked. And I don't think I need to go any farther along. That story was kind of a slow dissolve, and there he was standing up there talking to us. Well, I did not have a drink with my friends that night. I was really too scared. Could I be an alcoholic? What if I was hooked on it myself? What if I couldn't stop? I never thought about it, and I never had stopped long enough to find out. Never had occurred to me. Well, it turned out I wasn't. And incidentally, I didn't realize how lucky I was, because I can't drink coffee. I'd be in a hell of a shape. Now, I don't say that you saved me from alcoholism. We couldn't know about that. Maybe I haven't been saved. Maybe I've only been reprieved. I don't know. Or maybe I could have gone on like I was going forever and nothing would have happened to me. but I wouldn't want to bet on it. Now, I've not mentioned a higher power. I'm not going to make any guesses as to what part he played in all this luck that I had. I didn't ask him for it. But since I've been aware of it, I'm willing to thank him for it. That seems to work for you. Why should I fight City Hall? But what about my friends, all my drinking buddies, those years, who didn't have the good luck to wander into AA because they were working on a story? Well, most of them, I'm happy to report, are fine. Some of them are still getting stoned every night of the world and seem to be thriving on it. And some of them, luck didn't hold. Two of them, one girl and one man, are in AA. But only after a long and stormy voyage on which they lost everything but their lives. Another, a good friend, is dead of alcoholism. At least two others are practicing alcoholics, devoting full time to it. I wonder what would have happened to them if they had walked into AA when I did. Maybe nothing. Maybe they'd have gone right on down that lonesome road, and maybe not. Maybe with luck, their lives would have been different. Now, I come to a question. What I want to know is, how long are we big drinkers going to have to depend on luck, good or bad, to teach us about alcoholism? Now, I know I've got an awful nerve to ask that question here in front of you, who have done so much to get information to the public, to get information to anyone who wants it. But does a pre-alcoholic or a near-alcoholic or an early alcoholic know what he is or care? He might recognize the symptoms of early baldness in himself or early almost anything, but he's not going to recognize early alcoholism. He's not going to be that kind of a killjoy. But the information is there if he wants it. It's there in short form in that great book, Alcoholics Anonymous, on page 109. I quote, "His drinking may be constant or it may be heavy. Only on certain occasions, perhaps he spends too much money for liquor, may be slowing him up mentally or physically, but he doesn't know it. Sometimes he is a source of embarrassment to you or his friends. He is positive he can handle his liquor, that it does him no harm, that drinking is necessary to his business. He would probably be insulted if he were called an alcoholic. This world is full of people like him. Some will moderate or stop altogether, and some will not. Of those who keep on, a good number will become true alcoholics after a while." End of quotes. Now, who reads that? Alcoholics and their wives, sometimes. Not by any means always. Writers writing about alcoholism sometimes. I'll tell you who doesn't read it. Pre-alcoholics don't read it. Early alcoholics don't read it. Near alcoholics don't read it. Yes, there are also plenty of pamphlets available. Is AA for you? Alcoholism, the illness, danger signals for women drinkers, phases of alcohol addiction in males, 13 steps to alcoholism. These pamphlets can be the salvation of the apprentice alcoholic, if he knows about them. I didn't know about them until recently. And I'm not the dumbest one of the bunch, all these big drinkers. And if he's interested enough to ask for them, that's the catch. How many are interested enough to ask? Why should they be? They've got their jobs, got their families, and they're having a ball in life. I'm talking about the pre-alcoholic. What's a little drink between friends? Why be a gloom peddler? These are the people who have not fallen into the rapids yet, but they're standing mighty close to the bank and in a high wind, and they could slip at any moment and go under three times before they knew what hit them. What can be done to keep them from falling in? Well, we get back to education. More education and more education. I know you're not prohibitionists, and you're not evangelists, and you're not temperance workers, and I'm not asking you to be. I realize that in the very marrow of the bone of AA is the principle of laissez-faire. Join us if you want to. We won't drag you in, and we won't cram our God down your throat. In fact, bring your own higher power. All you need is a desire to stop drinking. But what about that poor fellow on that slippery bank above those rapids, that pre-alcoholic? He doesn't want to stop drinking. He doesn't even want to moderate because he doesn't think he needs to. He is not a suffering alcoholic, not yet, so he doesn't come within the scope of AA tradition. His job may be suffering, but he's not suffering. The people who love him may be suffering, but he's not suffering, not yet. Traditionally, then, he is not yet ready for the AA message because he has not yet fallen into the rapids. Now, it's not easy for me to stand here before you, you to whom I really do owe very much, maybe more than I know, and seem to be criticizing and asking that you do even more than you're already doing. But I'm not criticizing, really. I don't know any other way to put it. I just think that what you've got is so great that everybody, alcoholic or not, could do with a pound or two of it. Maybe I even think it's greater than you think it is. And that's why I wish you'd push it a little harder. I know you must remain non-aggressive. But do you have to be so aggressively non-aggressive? After all, you do mail out the book sometimes when it hasn't been asked for by the alcoholic himself, don't you? Yet, officially, the fellowship does not engage in the field of education. Members may participate as individuals, but the fellowship itself is not involved. Now, is this rather stringent dictum, and I'm going to get in trouble here. I feel it. If I get in trouble, you push that light, will you? Is this rather stringent dictum possibly a throwback to the early days of AA when it was struggling for its own self-confidence, for public acceptance, even for social respectability? And is there room now in the context of 30 years of accomplishment and worldwide recognition for a reevaluation of this dictum? I'm only asking. I'm not saying, I'm just asking. Has not education been an integral part of this movement from the beginning? Are we not all here because of that education? To put it another way, is not AA the result of the many being educated in the divine revelation of the few? And yet those many are still few compared to the need. Now I know that there are individuals and groups and organizations, many of them working on the education angle. But you're the people with a track record. And it's impressive. And it should be more available for others to see. One way to make it more available might be through an extension of the concept, and I'm going to get in trouble again, of step 12, to include the discreet, and I repeat, discreet, reaching out with knowledge to those in the unknown who may be in need of it, but may not know it, and therefore may not ask for it. That would only be a small extension of the present proselytizing that is already allowed under step 12, carrying the message to suffering alcoholics. I understand you already have a step 13. Somebody told me about it. And I want to congratulate you on that. This would be a cautious broadening of the base of step 12 to include education without evangelism. To include getting more literature on alcoholism and pre-alcoholism into schools, into newspapers, into television, motion pictures, even large business organizations, and certainly churches, without its necessarily having been asked for. There's plenty of room for another book, too. And God knows you got the writers for it. Probably more than the Writers Guild of America has. This one would be on pre-alcoholism. Might even be called a pre-alcoholic. No, I don't think for one minute that my constituents, the big drinkers, would flock to this book and read it and immediately moderate their drinking or stop drinking entirely, but some of them just might. And others might have a delayed reaction. And still others, probably those in the worst trouble, would pay no attention whatsoever, and you would just have to get them later. Less than 30 years ago, you were a young, uncertain fellowship, having nightmares, or so I've read, of collapse and disintegration. And today, you know you're here to stay. You started with one small miracle, and proliferated miracles into a commonplace. Who could have dreamed that from that small seed miracle, which sprouted 30 years ago, you would today be gathering miracles of reincarnation on a wholesale scale? There are, however, some things which I can think of which may be proliferating even faster than your miracles. Alcoholics. And they cannot reach out for help unless they are aware. What greater challenge can your faith and the strength and the responsibility of your maturity have? And doesn't this challenge require of you a more confident reaching out to them? You live by faith. Through faith you grow, not only in numbers and in strength, but in scope. Your faith reaches out, and as faith grows, so grows its reach. There are many who need this faith and have not yet been reached by it. And I believe that someday, through this higher power who works so well for you, they will be reached. Thank you.
Thank you, J.P.
Thank you, Mr. Carlberg, Mr. Collins. I was going to, in just a couple of minutes, ask for a round of applause for you people. I don't think I'll have to do that. I think that enough has been said. I don't think I need to add anything. This has been for me, and I hope for all of you, a pretty darn educational set of three speeches. We have to keep the door open. We have to spread information. We have the tremendous job of trying to eradicate misinformation about AA. This is often harder to erase than it is to plant true information. Thank you again, gentlemen. And thank you, audience. I think you've been a very good one.